Lecture 17, The Maccabean Revolt, Part 1.
The picture of the Hellenistic age that I've been painting in the last few lectures has not been a particularly attractive one. We've been looking at an age which was marked by coercion, where ordinary people were often afraid because of the uncertainty of the times. We've seen an age where cities were frequently left vulnerable and where they had to rely upon the goodwill of benefactors and kings to save them. And we've seen a world in which the power of the government was quite simply oppressive, where people faced constant daily danger, where there was a threat at any moment of being even carried off by a pirate and having your life end up as that of a slave. We might wonder if the Hellenistic age was as bleak as the picture I've been painting. Why did more people not revolt? Why did they not try to change the system that they had been given? Well, there are a couple of answers to this. One is that conditions in the ancient world had always been like this, that once you moved beyond the confines of a city and you were out in the countryside, it was frequently a dangerous place to be. That governments were frequently oppressive and kings were often oppressive, and so there really wasn't much of an alternative that offered itself to the power structure of the Hellenistic age. Another answer is that in fact rebellions did break out quite frequently. When probably the greatest of the kings of the Seleucid dynasty, Antiochus III, came to the throne in the early 220s, he faced a period of approximately 7 years when he lost much of Asia Minor to Achaeus, a usurper who proclaimed himself king, and then later on, almost as soon as Antiochus had finished with that threat, he then faced the threat of another would-be king, the self-proclaimed King Molon, who ruled in Media, east of Syria, for another 3 years from 223 down to 220. So many of the kings did face rebellions within their domains. Possibly the most interesting of these is that of a man by the name of Aristonicus, who tried to take over the realm of the Attalids after the death of Attalus III in 133 BC. You'll recall that I mentioned in an earlier lecture that Attalus III, wanting to save his kingdom from being torn apart, actually bequeathed the entire kingdom to the Romans. But Aristonicus would have none of this, raised a revolt appealing to the poor, the destitute, and even appealing to slaves to whom he offered freedom. They called themselves the men of the Sun State, the Heliopolitae, until the rebellion was finally put down. But the one revolt about which we have the most information, the revolt which tells us most about the conditions of the Hellenistic age and how people resisted Hellenism in some cases, is that of the Maccabees, the revolt that took place in Judea. It's the best documented, the best documented case, and so we should look at it in some detail. The revolt came in response to the desecration of the temple in Jerusalem by the soldiers of Antiochus IV. And in the next two lectures, I'd like to examine the events of this revolt in greater detail, asking how and why the persecution of the Jews took place in the mid-second century BC, and what their response to this and the revolt of the Maccabees tells us about the relationship between Greeks and non-Greeks, in other words, about conditions in the Hellenistic world. First of all, it has to be said that the persecution of the Jews by Antiochus IV and the eventual triumph of Jewish independence as a result of the Maccabean revolt are, of course, a story that resonates deeply in our century. It's very difficult for any historian to delve deeply into this story without bringing some modern analogues to bear. To put the matter quite simply, it's very difficult to read the accounts of Antiochus IV without thinking of him as, in some ways, an ancient precursor of Hitler's. By the same token, the Maccabean Revolt has attracted a good deal of attention in the 20th century because it appears as an example of a successful military resistance to what otherwise might have culminated in an ancient version of the Holocaust. So there are many ways, then, in which the Maccabean Revolt resonates in our time and in our age and demands our attention. But, and here's the important point, Although there are similarities, I want to suggest that in fact conditions in the mid-second century were very different, and that the phenomenon that we're examining is not really comparable to the modern persecution of the Jews at all. In the first place, there was no clear anti-Semitic context to these events in the Hellenistic world. The Greeks had not developed a sense that the Jews were an inferior race or even a culture to be dismissed. Up until the late 4th century, the Greeks knew very little about the Jews at all. And when they did come in contact with them, we have an account from one of the earliest Greek historians to have any substantial contact with Judea, a man called Hecateus, who wrote at the very end of the 4th century. And his account is really quite remarkable, because in his account, he tells a story clearly familiar with the Jewish story of the exile in Egypt and the return eventually to Israel. And according to Hecateus's account, this same flight out of Israel led to other foreigners going, some of who ended up in Greece. So that in Hecateus's account, the origins of the Greeks are really quite analogous to the origins of the Jews in Israel. And Hecateus writes at great length about a lawgiver comparable to a Greek figure like Solon or Lycurgus. And of course, it is Moses. So there was no sense in which there was a prior history, as there was in the case of the anti-Semitism that has been an unfortunate feature of European culture for hundreds of years. There was no ancient scientific theory that ever posited, in the worst way of the Nazis, that the Jews were biologically inferior to any other people, certainly not the Greeks. And there is no prior history before the events of the Maccabean Revolt of any legal restrictions placed upon the Jews within the empire of the Seleucids, analogous, for example, to the notorious laws passed against the Jews in 1933 in Germany. In fact, the exact opposite pertains in the ancient world. The Seleucids, the kings in Syria, whose empire included the area of Judea, had long dealt tolerantly with Jews, particularly Jews who had assimilated Greek practices. Antiochus repeatedly negotiated with high-ranking Jews in Jerusalem who went by such names as Jason and Menelaus and Lysimachus. These were men who clearly spoke Greek, who presented themselves to the world as Greek. They were, in our parlance, assimilated. They'd adopted the practices of Greek culture. And it was very easy for the Seleucid kings then to deal with these people because they didn't really see them as entirely foreign at all. The Jewish community in Judea was not a Jewish ghetto in the cities of Antioch or Seleucia or any other Syrian city. The Jewish community in Judea was a separate and completely distinct region within the Seleucid Empire. And the Seleucids were quite familiar with dealing with different ethnic groups. This was a region that paid its taxes on time, that sent tribute to the Seleucid king each year, and that it supported the Seleucid kings in their wars against the Ptolemies. Judea, quite simply, in the 2nd century BC, was a peaceful, well-integrated region within the Seleucid realm. The Seleucids ruled a polyethnic empire. They had many different people under their control, in Bactria and in the upper satrapies and in Babylon and in Asia Minor for a time. And their attitude, as we've seen on an earlier occasion, was utterly pragmatic. They let people be autonomous as far as possible and they respected local tradition as far as possible. So it was not in any shape or form in the interest of the Seleucid kings to antagonize the Jews, quite the opposite. Now, we have actually quite concrete evidence of exactly this policy of toleration that I've been trying to chart in the Seleucid realm. And it comes in a letter from King Antiochus, written to his governor in Judea, and it's recorded for us in Josephus, in his work, The Jewish Antiquities. And I'd like to read to you part of this because it's very important to keep in mind that this is the background out of which the persecution will grow. King Antiochus to his governor, greetings. Since the Jews, when we entered their country, at once displayed their enthusiasm for us, and when we arrived at their city, received us magnificently, and came to meet us with their senate, and have provided abundant supplies to our soldiers and elephants, and assisted us in expelling the Egyptian garrison on the citadel, we thought it right to repay them for these services and to restore their city, which had been destroyed by the accidents of war, and to repeople it by bringing back to it those who had been scattered abroad. And he goes on to detail, in quite astonishing detail, all of the steps to be taken to help the Jews back on their feet by sending them wine, oil, frankincense, wheat, salt, pieces of silver. And he says, I wish these grants to be made to them in accordance with my instructions, and the work on the temple to be completed together with the stowers and anything else which needs to be built. We're actually finding here a Seleucid policy of helping to rebuild the temple that's been damaged. The timber required for the woodwork shall be brought from Judea, for the other from the other nations and from Lebanon, and no one shall charge any duty on it. So a tax-free importation of the necessary goods for rebuilding the temple. And here, Antiochus III goes on to say, and this is a very important clause, all the people of the nation shall govern themselves in accordance with their ancestral laws, and the senate, the priests, and the scribes of the temple, and the temple singers shall be exempt from poll tax, crown tax, and salt tax. He goes on to give further examples of his beneficence. And later on, Josephus goes on to add that there was another clause in the letter from Antiochus. And again, this is quite remarkable. He says, no foreigner shall be allowed to enter the precinct of the temple, which is forbidden to the Jews, except for those who are accustomed to doing so after purifying themselves in accordance with the ancestral custom. So fairly clearly, what this document seems to show is that there is a policy not just of tolerance, but of actual respect on the part of the Seleucid kings. Antiochus says, no one shall bring into the city the flesh of horses, mules, wild or tame asses, leopards, foxes and hares, and generally of any of the animals forbidden to the Jews. Only the sacrificial animal used by their ancestors necessary for a propitious sacrifice to God shall they be allowed to use. Whoever transgresses these rules shall pay to the priests a fine of 3,000 drachmas of silver. So if that's the context, if that's the policy of Antiochus III, it makes the Seleucid persecution of the Jews under Antiochus IV even more of a puzzle. We have to ask, why did Antiochus IV turn against the Jews? Why did he turn against them? And what does the conflict between the two sides reveal about the relations between Greeks and non-Greeks in the Hellenistic world? Well, the oldest interpretation of Antiochus's policy is that Antiochus saw himself as a champion of Hellenism, which he intended imposing on his entire empire. In other words, his father's policy had been absolute toleration. One man turns around and says, we're going to change that, and instead we're going to impose Hellenism on the entire kingdom. The justification for this view goes back to one of the Jewish texts dealing with the revolt, the first book of Maccabees. And in the first book of Maccabees, we read that the king issued a proclamation to his whole kingdom that all were to become a single people and each was to renounce his own particular customs. So here we have in 1 Maccabees, and I'm reading verbatim, the king then issued a proclamation to the whole of his kingdom that they should all form one people and they should give up their own customs. And the author of 1 Maccabees goes on to say, all the nations acquiesced in this royal edict. Many Israelites accepted his worship and sacrificed to idols and profaned the Sabbath. The king also sent letters by messenger to Jerusalem and the cities of Judea, that they should follow customs alien to their land, banish holocausts, sacrifices and libations from the sanctuary, and profane the Sabbaths and festivals, defile the sanctuary and the holy men, build altars and sacred enclosures and idols' temples, sacrifice pigs and unclean animals, leave their sons uncircumcised, defile themselves with every kind of impurity and abomination so as to forget the law and change all their ordinances. And he goes on to talk about the further desecrations that took place as a result of this change in policy, so that on one particular day, one particular month, the first book of Maccabees records that they built the abomination of desolation on the altar. And in the cities of Judea around, they built altars and offered incense at the doors of houses and the streets. Any books of the law that they found were torn up and burnt. So this is a radical change of policy, with each of the various states within the Seleucid realm having to abandon its ways, and particularly the Jews being afflicted by this persecution. This explanation, of course, requires a remarkable about-face in Seleucid policy, because the original Seleucid policy, as we've seen, had been one of toleration. We've already read in great detail Antiochus III expressly confirming the rights of the Jews. And in fact, even in the second book of Maccabees, one of the other accounts of the rebellion that we have, the author of this, who of course is sympathetic to the Jewish side, has to concede that up until now the policy has been one of great friendship and respect. Second Maccabees says, "While the holy city lived in perfect peace, and the laws were strictly observed because of the piety of the high priest Onias and his hatred of evil, the kings themselves honored the place and glorified the temple with the most magnificent gifts." Into the first half of the second century, the Seleucids were treating the Jewish people as a distinct ethnic group within their empire, whose traditions were to be respected in precisely the same manner as the Seleucids treated their other subjects. So the abrupt change in policy is very hard to understand. Furthermore, there's actually very little evidence that there ever was such an official change in policy throughout the entire empire. Remember, the account that we had of Antiochus IV said he forced all the nations to abandon their customs. But there doesn't seem to be evidence that's supporting this. Local coinage throughout the empire continued to use local symbols and local types. It wasn't as if suddenly everyone started minting a Hellenistic Greek-style coinage. Throughout the other parts of the Seleucid realm, in Uruk and in Babylon, in Mesopotamia, there are no changes in the records or in the documentation to show any kind of sudden adoption of Hellenistic manners and practices. Across the Seleucid realm, the record after 167 BC reveals a continuation of exactly the same local and indigenous practices, local and indigenous cults. The same titles are being used as before 167 BC. So there's very little evidence to confirm this idea of a sudden proclamation of the enforced Hellenization of the entire Seleucid realm, and it's not a policy that would appear to make terribly much sense anyway. So we're in the rather peculiar position of saying that if Antiochus did issue a royal edict demanding the Hellenization of the entire Seleucid kingdom, the only place where we have evidence for this is the one place that chose to resist, namely in Judea. And this, of course, has led many people to suspect that the royal edict that we have in Maccabees is either a fiction or at least very different from whatever the king actually decreed. Some scholars have argued that what we really have here is an attempt by Antiochus not to impose Hellenism uniformly across his kingdom, but to foster a ruler cult in Jerusalem. And certainly we've seen good evidence before of the Hellenistic kings encouraging that kind of worship. According to this theory, Antiochus wished to be worshipped as the incarnation of Zeus Olympios, the father of the gods. But this explanation too, I think, falls short of the mark. Antiochus encouraged the worship of many gods, and he even presented himself as a god made manifest. He took on the title of Epiphanes, the god right here. But the practice of all the Hellenistic kings, as we've seen, was to graft this onto existing religious systems, or to encourage it among subjects who shared the outlook of the Greeks. The idea of suddenly going in, desecrating the temple, and erecting a statue of yourself as Zeus is one that is difficult to reconcile with this policy. So we've got, on the one hand, a long tradition of flexibility and of respect, and then we have a rather heavy-handed attack on the temple. How do we reconcile this? The Maccabean interpretation sees the persecutions by Antiochus as evidence for a clash of cultures, Greeks versus Jews. And most of the treatments that you will read of this will concentrate on only these two elements. But I'd like to suggest to you that a better way of understanding the Maccabean revolt is to think of other conflicts that lay beneath the surface of the simple Greek versus Jew. These other conflicts involve Jews on one side and Jews on another side, Hellenized Jews who have assimilated Greek culture and those who've resisted it. And also another level of conflict underlying the Maccabean revolt is the difference between the Jews living in the city and Jews in the countryside, where a whole different range of practices and attitudes was current. I'm going to argue, therefore, that there were really three major contributing factors that gave rise to the Maccabean revolt. One, the first was the plummeting fortunes of Antiochus IV, which made him amenable to a change in policy specifically involving the Jews. Two, the second contributing factor was a power struggle within the ranks of the leading families in Jerusalem, nearly all of whom had Hellenized, had assimilated. And the third factor, I'll suggest, was a widening gulf between the urban Jews of Jerusalem and those Jews of the countryside to whom Hellenism was anathema, to whom Hellenism represented an assault on Judaism. And I'll argue it's this volatile mixture of city versus country, Hellenized versus Orthodox, Greek versus Jew, and particularly the circumstances of Antiochus's rule that led to the persecution of the Jews in 168 and 167, and the Maccabean revolt that broke out immediately thereafter. So, let's start to work our way progressively through these different factors. First of all, Antiochus IV found himself in a difficult situation. The Seleucid realm in the generation before his coming to the throne had suffered a series of serious setbacks. In 189 BC, you may recall at the Battle of Magnesia in Asia Minor, the Romans had defeated Antiochus. Remember, they had been coming east. And in the following year, in 188 BC, the Syrian king Antiochus III had to sign a peace treaty at Apamea, which essentially gave up all of the Seleucid territory in Asia Minor. We have an account of the conditions of this peace treaty, the Peace of Apamea in 188, and the terms of this peace treaty would have crippled anyone with power less than Antiochus III, and it is really quite astonishing that the Seleucid realm managed to survive it. Because as a result of their military defeat at the hand of the Romans and of the treaty they signed the following year, Antiochus was forced to pay a crushing indemnity of 10,000 talents to be paid over 10 years in annual installments of 1,000 talents, enough to cripple any other kingdom in the Hellenistic world. In addition to this, he was forced to hand over hostages, he was forced to cede land to King Eumenes, and Seleucid power in Asia Minor evaporated overnight. Virtually all holdings north of the Taurus Mountains, all of what we would call modern-day Turkey, ceded at one blow. So this was a devastating defeat to the power of the Seleucids, as they lost virtually all of their western holdings. In 168 BC, shortly after Antiochus IV had come to the throne, he embarked on a campaign against young Ptolemy in Egypt, where he was met by a Roman magistrate by the name of Caius Papilius Linus. And I want to read you the details of the exchange between these two, because it is a most astonishing moment which will advertise the arrival now of Roman power in the Eastern Mediterranean and will help to explain something of the mindset of Antiochus IV because of the crushing defeat that he now faced. Not a military defeat like his father's, Antiochus III, but a diplomatic defeat. The details are amazing. When Antiochus IV had advanced against Ptolemy VI in order to take control of Pelusium, which is essentially the Gaza Strip, he was met by the Roman commander Caius Papilius Linus. The king greeted him by voice from a distance and offered him his right hand. But Papilius presented to him the tablet that he had in his hand, which contained the Senate's decree. So it's a lovely theatrical moment. The king puts out his hand, and instead of receiving the hand of the Roman magistrate, the Roman hands him a scroll and says, "Read this." And Linus asked Antiochus to read it first, before he would even shake his hand. "In my opinion," writes this historian, "he did not want to display any mark of friendship before finding out the intentions of the recipient, whether he was a friend or an enemy." So this is really a standoff, a diplomatic standoff between them. When the king had read it, this is wonderful, he said he wanted to consult with his friends on these new developments. Greek diplomatic language meaning, I want to consult with my court, with my advisors, my friends. But Papilius in reply did something which seemed insolent and arrogant to the highest degree. With a vine stick which he had in his hand, sort of a field marshal's stick, if you like, he drew a circle around Antiochus, and he told him to give his reply to the message before he stepped out of the circle. This is a bravado on the part of the Roman magistrate. The king was astounded at this arrogance, and after hesitating for a moment, he said he would do everything that the Romans asked of him. Thereupon, Papilius and his colleagues shook him by the hand and all welcomed him graciously. Now, what was it that he had agreed to by the terms of this astonishing act? The decree of the Senate required him to put an end at once to the war with Ptolemy. And so, within a stated number of days, Antiochus withdrew his army to Syria, deeply distressed at what had happened, but yielding to present circumstances. Papilius and his colleagues settled matters in Alexandria and urged the kings to preserve harmony. Now, this story is fascinating at many levels. Not only does it clearly show us signs of the Romans insinuating themselves into the affairs of the Eastern Mediterranean and becoming now the power brokers, two Hellenistic kingdoms, Seleucid Syria, Ptolemaic Egypt, at war, and who settles it? With a line drawn in the sand? A Roman magistrate. But even more than this, it gives us a remarkable look at the humiliation suffered by one of these great Hellenistic kings. Antiochus had been ordered to quit Egypt without winning his campaign, without winning anything to show for the massive effort, and without even having fought at all. He'd simply been bluffed by a Roman magistrate. His reaction to this humiliation in the following year was to show, or to try to demonstrate at least, to the world that Egypt and Rome were of no consequence to him. And so he mounted an extraordinary demonstration of his power back in Antioch, imitating the grand procession of Ptolemy Philadelphus that I described to you in an earlier lecture. Here, once again, a parade with all the wealth of a great Hellenistic kingdom on display. 50,000 men in armor. The full Seleucid army. They may not win a battle in Egypt, but at least they could look good turned out on parade. 800 cadets wearing gold crowns, 1,000 cattle for sacrifice, statues of the gods, of heroes, of nymphs, gold and silver plate and vessels. A great display, just like that of Ptolemy. It was a display that said he hadn't suffered any kind of setback at all. But of course, the reality was exactly the opposite. Within a generation, the Seleucids had lost all of their wealthy western realms, and they'd been bluffed by a solitary Roman commander and had failed in their attempt to conquer Egypt. This is the setting now that will lead to and overlap with the persecution of the Jews and the Maccabean Revolt. and it's to those events that we'll return in the second lecture on the Maccabean Revolt.